Hi, everybody. This is Christian, and I'm pleased to be joined today by Jim Rickards. Jim is the best-selling author of Currency Wars and his new book, The Death of Money. He's also the financial threat and asymmetric warfare advisor to both the Pentagon and the CIA, and the keynote speaker at our upcoming Belize conference. Jim, I wanted to thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Christian. I'm glad to be with you, and I'm very much looking forward to the Belize conference. I think it'll be, I know it'll be a great event.
So I'd like to start off today by asking you your thoughts on the state of our economy. The dollar seems to be flying high. Unemployment is low, though that may be mostly done with smoke and mirrors. Stock market's hit an all-time high. Where do you think our economy stands?
Well, that's a pretty good description, Christian. And, there's an old saying, you're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. And all three of your facts are correct. The dollar is high. Unemployment, at least as it's measured by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is low. It's come down a lot, and stock markets are at least close to record highs. Having said all that, my view is the U.S. economy is in terrible shape. That doesn't mean a collapse or a recession, although I wouldn't. Recession might be in the cards later this year, depending on how things play out. But we are growing right now. We're just growing very weakly. So let me just take a minute and explain why those three things that you mentioned are could be happening in a world where the U.S. economy is fundamentally weak. As I say, the first thing, the dollar is flying high. Well, it is, but for all the wrong reasons. I mean, we're getting capital inflows because everyone else is worse. Japan is in recession, Europe is in recession, China is still growing, but the growth has slowed down a lot. Russia is in a very severe recession. It's the eighth largest economy in the world. So all over the world, there are serious problems. So people are just saying, hey, I want to get dollars. So they're getting out of their capital markets. And it's not just those major markets I mentioned, but all emerging markets, Turkey, Indonesia, Brazil, South Africa, and elsewhere. This is something we're seeing all over the world. So you have these massive capital inflows. People are just saying, I want to buy dollars. Well, that's why the dollar is strong. And just to give a little more background on that, the genesis of that is the Fed's clear signaling that they intend to raise interest rates in 2015. Now, my view, and I've said this many times, I've been saying it for a long time, is that the Fed will not be able to raise interest rates in 2015. But ironically, the Fed will be the last to know because they're data-driven, but the data comes in real time. They say they're data-driven, but they're actually model-driven and data-driven, which is the way they look forward is with a model. And then the way they tack or adjust is based on the data. The models are badly flawed. They have been really for a long time. If you look at the Fed's forecasting record since 2008, it's the worst forecasting record you can find anywhere. Every year the Fed gives a one-year forward forecast. So in 2010, they say what the economy is going to do in 2011. And 2011, they say what the economy is going to do in 2012 and so forth. You go back and look at the last 5 years, they have been wrong by orders of magnitude. Now, I'm not talking a little bit, but, they say, 3.5%, it comes in at 2, and then they lower it to 3%, and it comes in at, 2.1. I mean, these are big misses in terms of GDP. And so that's a function of the fact that they have the wrong models. So they sat there in the middle of 2014. Their models told them that the U.S. economy is growing robustly, that the U.S. could begin to normalize interest rates. They finished the taper in late 2014. They signaled the market that they were going to raise rates, and they gave markets no reason to believe that they wouldn't raise rates. And the big debate on Wall Street among economists who were using the same flawed models, by the way, was, you go back to last summer, the debate was, well, would they raise them in March or June? You had your March people and your June people. Well, here we are in February. Well, they're not going to raise them in March. They're not going to raise them in April. My view is that they're not going to raise them in June either. In fact, they're not going to raise them this year. The markets have already shifted back those expectations. But again, this is something that I was talking about last year, and it's because the Fed is using these bad models. Now, the Fed is data driven. So as you go through 2015, and as the data comes in, we saw fourth quarter GDP. Recently reported that down significantly from the third quarter. We're seeing other metrics. Certainly we're seeing deflation rather than inflation. None of these things are playing out as the Fed expected them, which, as I say, comes as no surprise. So by April or May, the Fed's not going to be able to deny the data anymore. So what they'll do, of course, is begin to signal to markets that they're not going to raise rates anytime soon. But in the meantime, right now, as we speak, the expectation is the Fed will raise rates. And then you look around the world, you see China recently cut rates and cut the reserve requirements, which is the technical form of easing. Japan is just printing money and buying every bond in sight under the first era of Abenomics. The European Central Bank has now launched into their own form of QE. There's a little less there than meets the eye, but they're doing it. So if you're a global investor, you look around and say, well, okay, Europe, China, and Japan and others are easing. Looks like the U.S. is going to tighten. So as an investor, I'd rather bring my money to the U.S. where I can get a higher yield. And then once it gets here, people say, well, gee, what do I buy? You know, so a lot of them are buying notes. That accounts for the massive rally in 10-year Treasury notes, which was also, you know, trade I've recommended, and then also for the stock market bubble. So all these things are connected. But right now, you know, strong dollar is being driven by capital inflows. That's being driven by the expectation of a U.S. interest rate increase. That's driving various asset classes higher. And unemployment is only low because labor force participation has collapsed. Meaning, you know, I think most of the listeners are familiar with the fact that the unemployment rate is only a rate among those who are looking for work, either who have a job or are looking for work. But if you jump out of the workforce, you're not counted as unemployed. Now, you could be able-bodied, capable, experienced, but if you decide not to go looking for a job this week and you want to, you know, kind of sit on the couch and watch basketball and eat, you know, Fritos or whatever, you're not technically unemployed, even though you're not working. Well, that number, which is called labor force participation, is at the lowest it's been in the whole history it's been recorded. This goes back to the 1970s. So we're back to, you know, the Carter administration in terms of the number of people who are actually working, who actually have a job. So I think that's a better measure of workforce than the unemployment rate because, you know, for the reason I mentioned, which is there's an awful lot of productive capability that's sitting on the couch, not in the workforce, and that's going to drag the U.S. economy down. So putting all this together, yes, we do have a strong dollar, higher markets, and low unemployment, but behind the curtain, the strong dollar is based on expectations, going to be disappointed because the Fed won't raise rates. The low unemployment is based on the fact that people are just staying home, and markets are higher because money has nowhere else to go. So these things are all not sustainable. They'll turn around, but the fundamentals are very, very weak.
So I'd like to focus on those weaknesses and specifically the threats to the dollar that you detail in the death of money and the possibility that our dollar and thus the financial system in general could collapse in the near future. First, people throw around terms like failure and collapse all the time, often just to get headlines or push an agenda, but you define collapse very succinctly in the death of money. Can you talk to me about what you mean by a collapse in the dollar?
Yeah, what I mean, it's not that the dollar goes away or there won't be any dollars in the world. What I mean by that is a loss of confidence, a widespread loss of confidence. And the way that manifests itself, you know, we may still have dollars and we may get paid in dollars, but if you don't have confidence in the dollar as a store of value, as a store of wealth, you'll dump your dollars and go buy something else. What could the something else be? Well, it could be a lot of things. It could be gold. It could be silver. It could be land. It could be fine art. It could be natural resources. There are a lot of things you could buy, but what you don't want is to sit there and hold dollars in either, you know, bank account form or even dollar-denominated securities that are vulnerable to the depreciation of the dollar. Now, it's unlikely that this loss of confidence would happen to the dollar and not happen to other currencies as well. I mean, the dollar is still the leading reserve currency. 60% of all reserves in the world are held in dollar-denominated securities, mostly U.S. Treasuries, but also other kinds of you know, dollar-denominated stocks and bonds. So that's the case today. But if this loss of confidence comes and it spreads and feeds on itself, this is where you can go from deflation to hyperinflation very quickly. And a lot of people have trouble getting their minds around that, but I try to explain to people, you know, you've got to keep deflation and inflation in mind at the same time. They're opposite trends, no doubt about it. Most people have difficulty processing you know, completely opposite ideas at the same time. If I told you the world was definitely going to have inflation, you would know exactly what to do. You would know how to build your portfolio. If I told you the world was going to have deflation, again, you'd go to, you know, cash and notes and other assets, and you would know exactly what to do. But what I'm saying is that the world is in danger of both. Right now, deflation has the upper hand. Deflation is the dominant force. There's no question the world wants to deflate. But there are a lot of reasons why central banks cannot tolerate deflation, why they must have inflation, and they're doing everything possible, from rate cuts, quantitative easing, currency wars, forward guidance, Operation Twist, nominal GDP targeting, you name it, to try to get the inflation going. So that's the dynamic we're in, and I think investors need to be prepared for both of those. Now, either one of those will, at the end of the day, or perhaps both of them sequentially, we might have worse deflation and then some kind of remedy that could include a revaluation of gold or a devaluation of the dollar against gold, which is what happened in 1933, as a way to get the inflation machine going again. But either one of those things will, sooner or later, severely erode the value of the dollar. But my advice to investors is, you know, what are you waiting for? You can see this coming. Why wait? You know, you should build up some of these hard assets now, first of all, while you can still get them. In a panic, small investors will find that they can't get gold. You know, maybe some of the sovereign wealth funds and central banks or very large hedge funds will be able to get it from a few dealers, but, you know, you'll find that the mint stopped shipping it and your local dealer is sold out and everybody's back ordered and the warehouses are empty, and you literally won't be able to get the physical gold when the time comes, so you should get some now. Certainly the price will be much, much higher, even if you could lay your hands on it. But again, all these dynamics are playing out. So what I mean by the death of the dollar or the collapse of the international monetary system is simply a loss of confidence, followed by extreme outcomes, which could include a number of things. If there's a global financial panic or liquidity crisis of the kind we had in 2008, the international monetary system global elites would probably respond to that by issuing what are called special drawing rights. This is a form of world money issued and controlled by the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. There's nothing new about them. They've been around since 1969. They've been used in other panics, including the late 60s, early 70s, when Nixon went off gold, and they were used again in 2009 in response to the panic of 2008. So they're out there, they're only really issued as a last resort. But at this point, we're getting close to the point of last resort because central banks have trashed their balance sheets. I mean, I think a lot of listeners know that the Federal Reserve has increased its money printing and expanded its liabilities over 300%. Has printed, at this point, over $4 trillion. Of money, but they may not know that the People's Bank of China has printed more money than the Fed, and the central banks of Japan and Europe are printing money as fast as they can based on, again, Abenomics and Draghi's whatever it takes form of QE. So this is not just a U.S. phenomenon; it's a global phenomenon, and it has its own dynamic instability built into it. So again, you can see this collapse coming. It's already playing out. Really just a matter of time at this point.
So you talked about the IMF, and I'd like to return to that in a minute, but maybe we can just spend one more section on this need for trust. And what would be your view if the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve, if citizens, banks, central banks lost confidence in these two institutions, what could possibly result?
Well, I think trust is a key word, Christian. People like to say, well, the dollar's not backed by anything. And you look at, let's say, Bitcoin or any of these cryptocurrencies, and some people are skeptical of them, and they say, well, they're not backed by anything. Or you look at the IMF World Money, which are, again, called the Special Drawing Rights, or SDRs, and they're not backed by anything. And so you look around and say, none of these forms of money, and they're all just different forms of money, are not backed by anything. But I say, well, no, they are backed by something. They're backed by confidence and trust. If you and I or any transacting parties trust something or have confidence in something as a store of value, and we're willing to exchange it in the expectation that whoever receives it can exchange it with someone else at a future date for other goods and services, if we have that kind of confidence, then it's money. If you and I think something is money and we exchange it that way, it is money. But the point is, it is backed, you know, not by gold, not by rules, not by constraints, but by trust and confidence. The problem is that trust is very fragile. It can be lost easily. And once it's lost, it's very hard to regain. And that's one of my concerns about the international monetary system and the Federal Reserve in particular. They take trust for granted. They assume that will always be there. And then you can conduct this massive science experiment called, you know, quantitative easing. And by the way, when I call it an experiment, that's not sort of like name calling or pejorative. I've spoken to members of the Board of Governors, Federal Reserve Bank presidents, both current and former voting members of the FOMC. So I have occasion to speak to any number of central bankers. And behind the scenes, they won't necessarily say this publicly, but behind the scenes or privately, they'll tell you that they don't know what they're doing. They're making up as they go along. They try something. They see if it works. If it works, maybe they'll do more of it. If it doesn't work, they'll withdraw it and try something else. I mean, that's what they're doing. And that's just another way to describe a, you know, big economic science experiment. So that's what's going on. But meanwhile, while they're doing this, they take trust for granted. They assume the trust will always be there, and they can sort of pull the levers and twist the knobs and dials and try to optimize the outcome. But in the course of doing so, they're actually dealing with a much more fragile and unstable system than they realize, and they risk losing confidence. And once it's lost, things can collapse very, very quickly. So that's another reason I caution investors to kind of get your house in order now. Don't wait for the collapse, because when it comes, it will be too late.
And specifically as to the Federal Reserve, in your book, you mentioned that it's already broke on a mark-to-market basis, and Senator Rand Paul cited to your work on that topic recently. Can you say what you mean by broke on a mark-to-market basis?
Yeah, and again, that's it's important to focus on what mark-to-market means. What it means is that you look at the Fed balance sheet, or any balance sheet. It could be a hedge fund or a mutual fund or a bank or any entity. And they will record their assets based on certain accounting principles. Sometimes they're marked to market, meaning they're priced at today's market level or the level at which you could sell them. But sometimes they're held at a historic cost, meaning I paid something for it, and that's how I put it on my balance sheet. And even if the value changes in the future, I use that old cost. Now, about a year and a half ago, on a mark-to-market basis, if you took the Fed's assets and put them at current market value, the Fed would have been insolvent. And what that means is that their liabilities were greater than your assets. So if you have $100,000 in cash and property, but you owe $200,000 in debt, you know, you're insolvent. You're on the verge of bankruptcy because your debts are much greater than your assets. And that's the situation the Fed was in. Pretty scary considering it's our central bank. Now, that was true at the time when I said it and when Senator Paul said it. Now, just to be careful, it's probably not true today. That doesn't mean it's all good. All it means is that because interest rates have come down so much, you know, the value of a security moves inversely. Sorry, the value of a bond, a fixed income security, moves inversely to the interest rates. So if interest rates come down, the value of the security goes up. And conversely, if interest rates go up, the value of the security goes down. So again, a year and a half ago when I did this analysis, and I actually confirmed it with one of the members of the Board of Governors, and I did have a conversation with Senator Rand Paul about it, and he did talk about it on the floor of the Senate. It was true at the time. It might not be literally true today because interest rates have come down so much. Those 10-year notes that the Treasury holds have gone up in value, so they might have a positive net worth at this point. But it really doesn't matter in the sense that, you know, whether it's a little negative or a little positive at any point in time, the fact remains. The Fed is leveraged 80-1. The Fed looks like a bad hedge fund. The Fed has an enormous asset liability mismatch where they've jumped into assets with, 10-year maturities and so forth, and they've got these liabilities, which, I mean, technically are perpetual because, you know, you can't cash in a dollar bill, or at least it doesn't have a maturity on it. So they're issuing perpetual notes. That's what they call money. There could be, run on the bank if, people demanded assets and demanded cash. And so the point is, The Fed is, you know, bordering on a solvency. It has been a solvent at points in the past. If it's not technically the case today, so what? It is highly leveraged. It does look like a bad hedge fund. They've gone way, way beyond the role of the central bank. The role of the central bank should be to maintain price stability and act as a lender of last resort. The idea that they can micromanage the economy, create jobs. I mean, no one, I meet with PhD economists all over the world, policymakers and central bankers. No one has yet explained to me how printing money creates jobs. I mean, I know how to create jobs, and I've done it, and I see other people do it all the time. It's called starting a business and working hard and saving or building capital and having success and hiring people. That's how you create jobs. You don't do it by printing money. So why do the Fed thinks they can help the labor market by printing money is a mystery to me, but they think it's true. And again, I think it's that at the heart of a lot of these reckless policies we see.
Well, let's talk about the specific risks of printing money and the risks that you identify towards the dollar. What are some of the flashpoints you've uncovered in your research?
Well, some things are flashpoints, and other things are, I would say, persistent trends that are going to end up being flashpoints. So I tend to look forward and look at trends and system dynamics that I can see are leading to it's called a future flashpoint. One of them, of course, is the accumulation of gold by Russia and China. Since 2009, that's a convenient starting place in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. Russia has more than doubled its gold reserves, and China has increased its gold reserves several 100%, meaning 300 or 400%. No one knows the exact number, by the way, because they lie in their official statistics and don't reveal how much gold they're buying. But we have a lot of evidence. This is not guesswork. We can look at Chinese mining output. We can look at Hong Kong imports. We can look at transactions on the Shanghai Gold Exchange. So there's enough. I've met privately and had private discussions with gold refiners and secure logistics firms, people who actually move physical gold around the world in either armored cars or airplanes, et cetera. And we have enough information to know that China has some number, be it 3,000 or 4,000 tons or possibly higher, and possibly 5,000 tons. I will say every time I've done an estimate on Chinese gold, when I'm wrong, I'm wrong on the low side. In other words, the actual is bigger than my estimate, you know, and I update that once I get better information. But so China and Russia are acquiring all this gold. Now you have to ask yourself a question. Are they stupid, or do they see something that a lot of people don't? Well, I've spent time in Russia. I've spent a lot of time in China. I've met with people there. They're not stupid. They know exactly what they're doing. So my inference is that they see something we don't. They see this collapse of the currency that I've talked about, and they see a future role for gold in the international monetary system, whether it's a strict gold standard or a modified gold standard, or whether it just means that when the system collapses and you sit down around the table and rewrite the rules of the game, you know, your seat or your place at the table, it will be determined, or your voice at the table will be determined in some sense by the amount of gold you have. It could be any one of those three or some combination. But it doesn't matter. What it does mean is that gold will again play a significant role in the international monetary system. So, but if that's true, and I expect it is true based on this evidence, it won't be at $1,300 an ounce or $1,200 an ounce. You know, when people denigrate the gold standard or gold reference, they say, well, you know, you can't have a gold standard because there's not enough gold to support world trade and world finance. Well, that's nonsense. There's always enough gold. The question is, what's the price? At $1,200, no, there's not enough gold. But at $10,000, there's plenty of gold, or that is to say, the official gold in the world, valued at $10,000 an ounce, is enough to support world trade and world finance on some basis on a going forward basis. And so, so I see Russia and China accumulating this gold. It tells me that, you know, gold has a role in the future of the international monetary system. Furthermore, it cannot possibly be at $1,200-$1,300 an ounce, because that would be extremely deflationary. That would repeat the blunder of the 1920s when they got the price of gold wrong and led the world into a Great Depression. So to avoid that, they're going to have to get the price right. And you can do that math. It's not difficult. Just look at all the money in the world and all the gold in the world and make a few assumptions about the specifications of a gold standard in terms of what percentage backing do you want, whether you want to use M0, M1, or M2 is your definition of money. you know, a few other rules of the game. But I mean, the range that when I talk about, you know, $9,000-$10,000 an ounce, that's the low end of my estimate. The high end would be over $40,000 an ounce. Now, I'm not predicting $40,000 gold, but I can do eighth grade math, and those are the numbers. So, so that's where this is heading. So the flashpoint, excuse me, so my advice to investors is the flashpoint might be a couple years away. But why wait for it? You can see it coming. You can see the dynamics based on facts, not guesswork, not a crystal ball, but facts on the ground today. And so when you talk about flashpoints, it's a good question. But, again, I'm looking for future flashpoints, and you can see them. You can see them in the future based on what we know today.
And another of the future flashpoints you identify is the risks or potential fall of the petrodollar. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the fall of the petrodollar is really part and parcel or one facet of the overall collapse of confidence in the dollar itself. But just to be specific about that, you know, what do we mean by the petrodollar? This goes back to the mid-1970s. By the way, that was the last time the dollar was in as much distress as we're seeing today. I don't know if listeners are familiar, but in the late 1970s, the United States Treasury actually borrowed money in Swiss francs, issued Swiss franc-denominated U.S. Treasury bonds. They were called Carter bonds at the time because Jimmy Carter was the president. And that was because people didn't want dollars. Imagine that, the Treasury borrowing in foreign currency because people didn't want dollars. That's how bad it was at the time. And again, the IMF rode to the rescue with some SDRs. And of course, we all know what happened to the price of gold in that time frame. It went from $35 an ounce to $800 an ounce in the span from 1971 to 1980. But in the middle of that, when the dollar was sort of like a boxer, you know, bleeding badly and was back to the ropes, the problem was, you know, the price of oil was in the process of quadrupling, and the Saudis, who were leading OPEC and still do and pumping most of the oil and still are, said, we're not sure we want these dollars, because we're not really sure what they're worth. You know, the inflation seems to be out of control. Maybe we'll price oil in, you know, gold or Deutschmarks. At the time, there was no euro, but you could have used Deutschmarks. You could have used Japanese yen, Swiss francs, gold. There are a lot of ways to price oil, or SDRs for that matter. They don't have to be priced in dollars. But Henry Kissinger struck a deal. He was Nixon's national security advisor and secretary of state at the time, struck a deal with the royal family in Saudi Arabia that they would agree to price oil in dollars and furthermore take the dollars and put them back in the U.S. banks so that U.S. banks could then lend them to Latin American countries who would then buy U.S. exports such as, tractors, equipment, aircraft, machines, et cetera, or agricultural exports. And then those flows would help the U.S. finance the price of oil. So it was a big circle where the dollars went from the U.S. to Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia back to U.S. banks, U.S. banks to South America and elsewhere, and then those countries would buy U.S. goods and we would get the dollars back. So that's how the financial system was patched up at the time. But the Saudis said, well, okay, what's in it for us? And what the U.S. said is, we will guarantee the continuation of your rule, the rule of the House of Saud. I mean, I could say national security, but it's not really a nation. It's more of a kingdom. But whatever form of governance you want to call it, we would guarantee its perpetuation against enemies in the region. You know, everything from Iran to, you know, Russia at the time. Bear in mind, this was all during the Cold War. And that was the deal. So the Saudis said, okay, we'll take your security guarantee in exchange for which we will recycle the dollars. And that was the petrodollar deal. Now, that was an important prop under the value of the dollar, under the role of the dollar in the international monetary system. Because if you think about it, you know, not everyone needs dollars in the first place, but everybody needs oil. And if oil is priced in dollars, then you need dollars to buy the oil. So this forced everybody in the world to keep taking dollars because they needed them to get the oil. And that was a very powerful support or prop under the dollar, which was under a lot of pressure at the time. And that has been in place ever since. Now, come forward to today, 40 years later, what's the situation? Well, we have reneged on our security guarantee. President Obama has declared a form of détente with Iran. Iran is an existential threat to Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia's worst enemy. And so Saudi Arabia looks at us and says, okay, guys, you know, you're now in detente with Iran. That's our enemy. So you've reneged on your security guarantees. Maybe we'll renege on the dollar. Now, it doesn't mean it happens overnight, or it doesn't mean it's going to happen tomorrow morning. But at the margin, as the role of the Chinese yuan expands, as the IMF prepares, which I expect later this year, to include the yuan, the Chinese yuan, in the special drawing right basket, in the SDR basket, which kind of confers de facto reserve currency status on the yuan, and as Saudi Arabia prepares perhaps to accept yuan in payment, and this will be like you have a three-legged stool and you pull one of the legs out, the stool is going to fall down. So that's the dynamic there. That's one part of the collapse of the dollar, but it's not the only one. I mean, we've actually touched on two of them. The first one was gold accumulation by Russia and China. The second one is the collapse of the petrodollar deal with Saudi Arabia. And then the third one is that basically the Fed's monetary policy itself and global easing. So you can see this coming from all directions.
And you've mentioned the IMF a couple times, and you make a very compelling case in The Death of Money that the IMF is looking to eliminate the dollar and maybe step into its place as the world currency, and that the IMF is possibly the last man standing with a clean balance sheet. What is in it for the IMF to replace the dollar as a transactional currency?
Power. In other words,
simple.
The IMF will be the central bank of the world. And there's a big shadow struggle going on right now in Washington. You know, the IMF is headquartered in Washington, and of course, the U.S. Congress is there, and there's sort of a death match or cage match between Christine Lagarde and the Republican leadership in the Congress over some backdoor deals between the United States and the IMF. Now, in September 2009, at the Pittsburgh G20 summit, President Obama gave a promise to the IMF that we would step up to $100 billion contribution to the IMF fund, which is being put together to bail out the world. This was in the aftermath of the 2008 crisis, but actually came before the European sovereign debt crisis, which didn't emerge until, well, started in Dubai the day after Thanksgiving 2009, and then just spun out of control in 2011, 2012 with Greece, Portugal, Spain, Ireland, and the whole peripheral sovereign bond crisis in Europe, when they needed, the IMF needed money to bail them out. And today they need money to bail out Ukraine. So, Christine Lagarde's looking around saying, hey, I don't have enough money. I need all you know, big, economies to pledge some. And the U.S. pledged $100 billion. Now, Barney Frank, snuck in an amendment in the defense appropriation bill and got that through the Congress. But we never funded it. It's kind of like a line of credit. It's like if you have a line of credit on your MasterCard, but you don't use it. So the IMF sitting there thinking they have a $100 billion line of credit on their credit card, but the U.S. has never actually given them the money. Now, fast forward to today, the IMF has changed that deal and said, well, okay, we'll let you off the hook on the $100 billion, but in exchange, we want you to convert the debt to equity, what they call quotas, and we want you to agree to change the voting at the IMF so that China can have more votes. But so far the Congress has refused to approve that. That actually does need to be approved by the Congress. And Christine Lagarde last year threatened the U.S. Congress. She said, if you don't get it done by the end of 2014, she gave the Congress a deadline of December 31st, 2014. If you don't get it done by then, we're going to go our own way. We're going to change the rules, possibly take away the U.S. veto, because we do have a de facto veto at the IMF, and reduce your voting rights anyway, and increase the voting rights of China anyway, and go from there. So right now we're at the stage where she's kind of begun the governance process to do all those things, take away the U.S. veto. The White House actually supports the IMF in this, and everyone's trying to hold a gun to the head of the Congress, the Republicans in Congress, to get this through. So let's see what happens. But this is going to be a pretty momentous year for the IMF. Either the U.S. will approve this legislation, in which case we keep the veto and keep our votes, put up a lot more money so she can do more bailouts, but China will get more votes anyway because that's already in the cards. Or we don't approve the legislation, perhaps lose our veto, lose our votes, and watch China and the other BRICS and other large countries sort of take the IMF in the wrong direction. So it's a pretty big deal. We can probably add this to the list of things that could undermine the dollar. We talked about the petrodollar. We talked about gold. And now we're talking really about SDR, special drawing rights from the IMF. So they're just, you know, when you have three, four, or five threats and they're all pointing in the same direction, you don't have to be, you know, Leonardo da Vinci to figure out that things are going to end badly. Hey, Christian, it's been a great call. Hoping we can wrap up here. And again, I hope a lot of the listeners will join us in Belize. I'm looking forward to going down there and being part of the conference and meeting folks in person.
Yeah, thank you, Jim. This has been extremely helpful, and I look forward to seeing you in Belize.
Fantastic.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye.